That's Les McCann on his Fender Rhodes electric piano and Eddie Harris on electric saxophone. He developed the instrument, by the way, with Set Us Free. It's from their 1971 album, Second Movement. Cornell Dupree on electric guitar, James Rouser on string bass, Donald Dean on drums, Buck Klar on African drums and percussion. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. Well, we are going to be talking about two subjects that we've been following for some time. Today, we get some updates on them, very important updates on them. And in one case, something entirely new. But we start out in Haiti and the Dominican Republic. Kim Ives, as you know, is a familiar voice on Lead Stories, and he has been talking to us and educating us about matters pertaining to Haiti. He is a co-founder and editor of the international weekly newspaper Haiti Liberté. He is an award-winning filmmaker, and documentarian. He's been in Haiti and the Dominican Republic following two key stories we've been discussing. Haiti's elections, they started on October the 25th, no results yet. And the other story, the deportation of Haitians from the Dominican Republic on the basis of race-specific laws. Kim, great to have you with us today.
Thank you, Eutrice. Always a pleasure to be on your show.
Thank you. I know the strength of the signal where you are may be a little dicey, but we are going ahead. It's great to have you with us. Well, so Haiti began its elections on October the 25th. No results yet, but lots of charges about widespread fraud. What do you know? What have you been observing?
Well, what we observed, Haiti Liberté's correspondence fanned out on Port-au-Prince the day of the vote, Eutrice, and we visited about close to 100 what they call voting centers. Each voting center has voting bureaus, sometimes as many as 50 or 60. And so we took a polling of these centers, and what we found was there was, first of all, a very low participation in the election. The average of the voting bureaus that we checked was 14.7%. So, okay, let's say in other areas it might be a little higher. We're still talking well below 25%, which is about the lowest in the hemisphere participation that you find. The last election was 23%, I think, officially, and that set a record as the lowest participation in a presidential election in the hemisphere in the past 70 years. So Haitians like elections, real elections, and so this says something about that. But what we saw also as we were going through the voting bureaus is that these voting bureaus are all right next to each other. Sometimes there's two or three and one in the same room. And generally, the results are going to be the same or close. That is, there were four leading candidates in this particular election. Jovenel Moïse of the Martelly government, who had the most advertising in the country. His pink posters were on every wall and lamppost. Jude Celestin, who was the candidate knocked out in 2010. He's affiliated with President René Préval and also has had a very well-funded campaign, has had people like Wyclef Jean musician support him. And then you have two currents of the Lavalas, Maryse Narcisse, who represents President Aristide's sort of official Lavalas, if you will call it, Famille Lavalas, which has not participated in an election since 2000. And then a sort of breakaway candidate who's somewhat more radical, has been more outspoken about Martelly's corruption and about the international military occupation of Haiti, and that's Moïse Jean-Charles, a former mayor from the north of the country. So those four candidates were in the lead, but to your original question, what we saw was that sometimes, and I'm not going to name the candidate because the voting bureaus may change their voting tallies when reviewed by the KEP, but there was sometimes a candidate or two where you would see, 15, 17, 12, 10 for each one of the candidates. Say a spread along those lines within 5 or 6 points of each other. And then suddenly in one voting bureau, you'd see that there was a 50% participation and one of the candidates got 84 votes, for example. So immediately you knew that this was a little questionable, that all the neighboring voting bureaus had 16 or 12 or 9 votes for that candidate, and suddenly one voting bureau had 84. So I think there has been a lot of charges of voting fraud. The campaign of Moïse Jean-Charles in particular said they found a whole box full of ballots that had been given to him that had been taken and was in the process of about to be destroyed by the Jovenel Moïse, that is the Martelly government's candidate's campaign. And there have been a number of other cases that this popped up. So we'll see. Tomorrow, the 3rd of November, is when the results are supposed to be given. And this KEP already has been under tremendous pressure from the August 9th election, which were a complete a fiasco in terms of fraud and repression and disorder. This one had less violence, and so the international community and mainstream press has said, oh, it was a great success. They used violence as their only criteria. But it looks like the fraud may well be in place, and sometimes you trace, just to finish up, you know, they might count the votes well, but the way they calculate the result in Creole, they have a saying, bien compté, mal calculé. You count well, but you calculate badly. We fear that could be about to happen, too.
Well, you to follow up on your response, you did make a notation that generally Haitians are very, very involved in elections. But yet you were saying the participation rate at this time was about 14%, but in any event, extremely low. Is this, what accounts for the low turnout? Was it in fact low or just as a function of the level of corruption or the fraud that has occurred or is occurring? Or is there something else that is accounting for the fact that people appear to have been staying away?
Well, as I'm sure you've talked about on your programs, Utrice, especially being here in Florida, the masters of this planet, of the universe, as it were, have been doing their utmost to really find a way to weed out the poor and working people from the electoral process in this country, and they do it through things like felony restrictions on voters, and as we know, many working class people, particularly black and Latino working class people, have a scrape with the law, usually on the basis of the racism of the cop, and end up having some sort of felony against them, and now they can't vote. Well, in the 1990 election in Haiti, you had close to 100% participation. Haitians designed their own vote. And, for instance, the way you did it was you went and you registered at a local voting bureau, and then you went to the same voting bureau to vote. And it worked very well. Everybody could vote. But since that time, they did a coup d'etat against Aristide in 91. They did another coup d'etat against him in 2004. In the U.S., and what they call, the euphemism is international community, has basically come in and, you know, whispered in the ear of these electoral councils, which they also have a big influence in picking. And what they've done is they've changed a lot of the rules. And so this current electoral council has said, you have to vote where your electoral card was issued. So if you're electoral card was issued, say, in the north of the country, up in Cape Haitian, if you happen to be in Port-au-Prince on election day, you're plumb out of luck. You're not going to vote because you have to go back to Cape Haitian. I experienced this firsthand. That house where I was staying, there was a contractor there, a boss, they call them in Haiti, who was putting on wrought iron on the house. And it was a job. He had to do it. He was from Okai. He'd gotten his electoral card in Okai. So he kind of shrugged his shoulders. He said, well, I guess I can't vote. Maybe I'll be able to vote in the second round. Well, this is the situation for, I could say, 60, 70% of Haiti's population, which are poor people trying to find jobs around the country, maybe in another town far away. Or merchants, you know, they have whatever wares they have. Maybe it's bananas, maybe it's coffee, maybe it's charcoal, what they call charbon, or maybe it's chiclets. But, you know, you have to travel to another city to sell it, and so you might not be home at that time. So it's a mobile population. So what did they do? They put in a restriction that basically makes it impossible for mobile people to vote. And so I think this was part of the reason that the population was really it was disenfranchised in this vote. And you add to that the fact that the first round, which was for the first round of legislative elections on August 9th, was so violent. So many people were beat up, shot at, intimidated, and there was so much fraud that I think a lot of people just said, you know, I don't want to go out for that. And then there's also a large sector, it has to be said, who feel that there can be no free, fair, and sovereign elections with Martelly in power and with Haiti under a foreign military occupation, because basically it's going to be the UN, the OAS, that is to say the two lieutenants of Washington, who will be the final arbiters of this vote.
Speaking of that, Secretary of State John Kerry, as the elections were about to be held, kind of forewarned that the U.S. is expecting free and fair elections. They did not make any mention of the fact that all these barriers to voting, just like in the United States, were already in place. We had some members of the Congressional Black Caucus going down to supposedly observe elections. They have made no statements around concerns about barriers to participating in the process. So when the Electoral Council announces the decision tomorrow, to what degree would the result, whatever it is, to what degree would the result actually reflect the will of the Haitian people?
Well, yeah, that's the $64,000 question, isn't it? And we'll see. To me, there are three possible outcomes, Eutrice. The first is that the two, I could say, regime candidates or regime acceptable candidates or Washington acceptable candidates, Jovenel Moïse, who is Martelly's candidate, banana exporter from Port-au-Prince, and a virtual political unknown in the country, we could say, and Jude Celestin, who is, again, affiliated with former President René Préval. It could end up being a runoff between those two, or, and this I expect more, it could be either Jovenel and Jude with one of the Lavalas current candidates, that is either Maryse Narcisse or Moïse Jean-Charles. And then the real long shot, I'd say there's almost a 0.01% of this, is that we would have a runoff between the two Lavalas currents, between Maryse Narcisse and Moïse Jean-Charles. My guess is that, you know, we're probably going to see something like Jude Celestin, and to me, Washington's money is on him. Frankly, Utrice, I think that it's come to a point where Washington is more sophisticated than it was in 1990, where they put all their money on one candidate, a guy called Marc Bazin, former World Bank economist, who's going to carry out the neoliberal plan, a very polished guy who lost dismally to the slum father, Jean-Bertrand Aristide, who got 67% of the vote, and Bazin got something like 13 or 14%. So I think now their approach is more sophisticated. I think whoever comes in, whether it's Jovenel or Jude or Maryse or Moïse, they kind of have a dossier on anybody, and they know that they're going to be able to put pressure on them and to, you know, browbeat and bribe and bully them. To some extent, I think they would prefer Jude Celestin. He's more, I could say, of a mercenary. He has no real, since being pushed out of the 2010 race, you haven't heard anything from him. So probably that. But the most important point to say, Utrice, is that really the president is almost more of a symbolic post. He doesn't really, or he or she doesn't really have executive power. That goes to the prime minister. And the prime minister is chosen by, if there is a majority party in the parliament, the majority party in parliament. And that is looking like it will be either the Martelly party or a combination of Martelly parties. So whoever ends up being elected president, they may find themselves with a Gordian knot, or a straitjacket, shall I say, that makes it very difficult for them to do anything. Seriously.
But it still maintains the status quo with respect to U.S. interests there and U.S. control there.
For sure, and that's the whole point. Yeah, I think that, the U.S., their principal idea in Haiti is this is a rebellious country, the first and last successful slave revolution, the first country to fight against U.S. Imperialism in 1915, 100 years ago, the first country to rise up against a U.N. Military occupation in the past 11 years that has been deployed in Haiti. So I think, you know, they really are looking for a way to keep a lid on this very explosive place.
Wow. So we will, of course, update. You'll give us an update when the Electoral Council announces the, quote, winner, unquote, and what the fallout is. But just before we switch to the other subject, the related subject, I just wanted to ask, how are people supposed to interpret this thing? What sense are we to make of this election in Haiti, and why does it matter to pay attention to it?
Well, I think it matters because, as we see, the same tactics and the same laboratory that is finding a way to disenfranchise the working poor here in the United States is hard at work in these neo-colonies like Haiti, trying to find a way to you know, push back against these people rising up. And so we have a lot to learn from it. Plus the fact that, you know, it should be said that the instability that is created through this foreign intervention in the sovereign process of elections in Haiti, it ends up destabilizing the country. It means Haitians have to leave, sometimes by sea, sometimes by air, to come to the U.S. to find a way to survive and keep their families fed. And sometimes they end up going across the border to the Dominican Republic.
Speaking of which, how is it going, the mass deportation by the Dominican Republic of Haitians and descendants of Haitians back to Haiti or anywhere else but out of the country? Could you give us an idea of how it's going?
Well, I think that the international outcry and the uprising that has happened not just in Haiti but throughout the world it has stayed the hand, if you will, even though all the legislation is in place, even all the repressive apparatus is in place, but it has stayed the hand temporarily, I think, of the Dominican government in expelling Dominicans of Haitian parentage. Just to review for listeners who may not have heard our previous shows, but essentially through a series of legislative and votes and judicial decisions, Dominicans who have Haitian parents who were not legalized, even if they were born in the Dominican Republic and have lived all their lives in the Dominican Republic, going back as far as 1929, are retroactively have had their citizenship stripped. That is, they are no longer considered Dominican, even if they know no other country, know no other language than Spanish. And this has outraged the world, outraged Haitians, and to some extent, I think the Dominican government has not begun, even though there have been some deportations, but just a handful, really, not the massive deportations that had been expected. But I think this is because they feel the eyes of the world are upon them, and we're trying to keep it like that. That said, the border right now has, for all intents and purposes, been shut down. I haven't heard over the weekend. I haven't heard exactly what happened, but I, for instance, went from Port-au-Prince to the Dominican Republic last week, and when I got to the bus station, they said, "Oh, sorry, no buses." Well, that's because the bus lines have been shut down, and as of Thursday, the truckers' unions have said they're going to completely shut all motorized traffic going across the border. Now, why is that? Well, it's because the Martelly government, in a sense, in response to this same international outcry, had to ban 23 products, everything ranging from mattresses and laundry soap to flour and beer and PCV pipes from being brought across the border. There were about 200 trucks a day at one point that were bringing, you know, cargo across the road from Dominican Republic to Haiti. And they said, no, these things can't be brought by land. They can be flown in, they can be shipped in, but they can't be brought by land. Well, this was to some extent, in the estimation of most people, a kind of a face-saving measure, a symbolic gesture to make it look like they were doing something to protest the treatment of Dominicans of Haitian descent and Haitians as well in the Dominican Republic. But the truckers, both the Dominican truckers and the Haitian truckers who had been making money from the import of Dominican products into Haiti have been feeling the pinch. You know, they no longer can bring stuff across and feed their families and so forth. So they have risen up and said they want this ban on the import of Dominican products lifted so that they can continue doing the shipping that they've been doing. So it's a very complicated situation. And both the Dominican and Haitian government, I mean, you have to think, Eutrice, just to finish, Dominican Republic has exports of about $8 billion a year. $7 billion of that goes to the U.S. and the European Union, and that's controlled by about 10% of Dominican exporters. The remaining $1 billion in exports goes to Haiti, and 90% of Dominican exporters are involved in that. So you have 90% involved in that $1 billion trade with Haiti. So both for Danilo, the Dominican president, and for Martelly, this is a very difficult and complex political knot to untie.
Well, how did this, well, it's a refugee crisis now, how did this crisis mm-hmm. play into the Haitian elections?
Well, I think a lot of people have seen that Martelly was a photocopy practically of the corrupt Dominican government and all sorts of wheeling and dealing with them, meetings which came to nothing. And so in many ways, the way he handled the crisis with the Dominican Republic, with this neighboring country, has been one of the issues which has lent to the complete opposition to his candidate, Jovenel Moïse. So I think this provides a sort of a backdrop and I could say one of the principal issues that people are why they're voting against the candidate. I can't say that the huge publicity campaign in terms of giant posters, giant billboards, flyers everywhere, radio ads, television infomercials, ad nauseum, haven't had their effect the same way they do here in the United States. And I should just say that, you know, as Patrick Ely, one of the well-known long-time democracy activists, told me in Haiti, said basically they're turning the elections in Haiti to become just like those in the U.S. It's money that decides, not the people. And so this is the big problem. But, you know, the way that Martelly government has handled the Dominican Republic crisis has lent a lot to its lack of credibility.
But just the same, Kim, we have this crisis compounding the problem of how these Haitians who were displaced and made homeless by the earthquake, who are still thousands by the thousands living in open air under tents that were supposed to have been replaced by some degree of housing by now under the Clinton plan, added to that domestic turmoil and that sense of the crisis, we have mm-hmm. the returning people who have been dispossessed from the Dominican Republic. So on a social Correct. Level, how are these folks, these new people coming in, being returned to Haiti, and in some cases just being sent to Haiti, how on a social level are they being dealt with?
Well, we had an article a couple of weeks ago in Haiti Liberté, which, again, can be found if you don't find the paper in your neighborhood at HaitiLiberté.com. That's liberty with an E on the end. One of our correspondents went out to the border to see just what kind of reception centers had been put in place to receive this expected wave of refugees, and what he found was essentially about a 6-acre white gravel lot in the middle with a little lean-to in the middle of plywood with no walls, in which there were three soldiers sitting. There was a very nice sign that said the Welcome Center, which was established by the Ministry of the Interior. And the people in there were dressed as soldiers. They even had on camouflage pants. So they were finding something to do with the supposed Haitian army that they want to reestablish. But that was the extent of it. There was essentially nothing. There was no water. There was no building. There was no staff. There was no table. There was nothing. So they had a very nice sign, though. I have to say, the sign was very big and very well designed.
So when we take all of this into perspective, what do we see as a reaction from the international community? Certainly those organizations and NGOs that were committed to the rebuilding, as Clinton put it, Bill Clinton, building bigger and better. What is their response to what's going on here?
Oh, my God. I think it's the ostrich policy. I think, as we can see, Hillary is avoiding the word Haiti like the plague. Bill has totally disappeared, been chased by the chorus of outcry against his leadership. I mean, you know, this is the thing. When you suddenly put on a leadership hat and you're, you know, representing the Secretary General and you're the head of the International Haitian Recovery Commission, which had the mission of build back better for Haiti, and the only thing you do is build a couple of luxury hotels and a sweatshop, which is at the other end of the country from where the earthquake hit, up in the north in Caracol, you know, people are going to start to answer questions. What did you do with this $16 billion in world solidarity that got showered to Haiti? Well, the fact is that most of it never even left the United States. It went right back into the pockets of the NGOs and the Beltway contractors that were supposed to carry out the work. And, you know, Haitians find themselves essentially once again having been the mere scenery for another looting of the treasury, this time the treasury which contained humanitarian earthquake funds. So I think Bill Clinton, for all his beautiful words about having a real chance now to make things right in Haiti and build from the ground up and blah blah blah, is basically running away. And one thing we should mention, Utrice, is even Bill's and Hillary's daughter, Chelsea Clinton, who whose email to her parents was revealed in the Freedom of Information Act releases of Hillary's emails, revealed that, you know, she was saying, listen, Mom and Dad, the job you guys are doing here in Haiti, I mean, she didn't say it like that, but I'm paraphrasing. It's nothing. You know, the people are clueless, arrogant, misdirected, and Haitians want to help themselves. Let's help them do that. So this chorus of outcry is coming even from Bill and Hillary's offspring. Are you with? Am I there?
Yes, I'm here. Oh, we lost you for a little while there.
Oh, you lost me. Oh, boy. Okay, I don't know.
Just for a little while, but that's for a little while. You're back, and that's great. So let's wrap up and say, what do you expect tomorrow, and how is it going to be regarded, or what is the reaction you think, based on your prediction as to where the council would likely go, and what you think the reaction would be?
Well, as I said, I think there is going to be again, an adjustment, shall we say, an adjustment of the vote. As I said, we saw there was some irregularities in the voting bureaus that we collected during the evening of October 25th, and I think that will be augmented by the fact that there has been a lot of hinky-panky in the way the numbers have been treated in past elections and even the most recent first round of elections on August 9th. So I think if experience is any guide, that the U.S. government is not going to just put Jovenel Moïse and Jude Celestin, who I think are their two preferred candidates, in the runoff. I think that would lead to an explosion. People from the Lavalas currents, both the Maurice-Narcisse current and the Moïse-Jean-Charles current, would take to the streets. They would maybe even join together in outrage and demonstrations. The country would become a powder keg, or I would say it would be an exploding powder keg. It is presently a powder keg. So I think their wisest tactic, and the one I assume they would take, would be at least to put one of the Lavalas currents in the runoff. So I expect either Jovenel Moïse or Jude Celestin to be one of the candidates, and then either Maurice Narcisse or Moïse Jean-Charles to be the other candidate. And then the big showdown will happen on December 27th. So that's when the final round is, the runoff is, and, you know, that's when we may see the final hour of reckoning.
Thanks, Kim, for this update. Greatly appreciate your work, and thank you so much for the insights that you bring to Lead Stories on Haiti and related developments. Thank you.
Well, thank you to you, Trace, again for having me, and I hope to talk to you again soon.
Will do. Well, 180 years ago today, bands of First Nations warriors and Africans who had freed themselves from slavery engaged U.S. soldiers in Florida in defense of their land and their freedom. Lasting for 7 years, in fact, longer than the U.S. Civil War, from 1835 to 1842, it was the second time between 1816 and 1858 that U.S. forces would meet combined military resistance. I thought it important to bring this to your attention today because this particular episode, this period of time, represents the coordinated military and tactical effort made by people who were under the gun, literally, by the U.S. government. This is how they responded to, in the case of the First Nations, to a concerted effort to just slaughter them and take their land. In the case of the Africans, to work them to death once the land was appropriated. My dear friend, the late Professor Jan Carew, brings to light this neglected chapter of U.S. history, erroneously recorded as the Seminole Wars. We may not have time to finish the entire lecture today, but I do want to introduce you to the substance of the idea that he was talking about. This is back in 1990.
Separate us. They separate us from ourselves. They separate us from our ancestors, from our history, from our families. They divide us up into little fragments. And they never tell you about the unities in struggle that took place in history. And so my historiography hones in just on this point. Because the logic of the situation is that if people were oppressed, like the Native Americans were and the African ancestors were, obviously they resisted the oppression. And obviously, as intelligent human beings, it occurred to them that by uniting against a common foe, they would have greater strength in the struggle. But the histories lie there waiting generation after generation. And then I pick up the books by Boyd Thatcher, who is a great admirer of Columbus. But in those books I find that in 1502, there is a rebellion, a major rebellion, in which blacks and Native Americans join forces. 1492 to 1502. That's 10 years. And in that time begins a struggle. And you're going to find this uniting of the oppressed threading its way through the entire history for five centuries. And one of the great epics of the struggle took place in, of all places, in Florida. You know, we have black studies departments all over the country, and do you know, I have seen not one single piece about this to train our children, because the way you defeat someone, you defeat them in the mind first. That's why Garvey said, first you must change your way of thinking, and then peacefully carve up the weapons with which to fight. So they assault the mind. They tell you about rebellions that Nat Turner and Denmark Vesey and Posner. But if you notice, all of them were betrayed. They didn't win. And the one great insurgency that blacks fought in this country for over 130 years is one of the best kept secrets in black history. And it took place in Florida. And you read about it as the Seminole Wars. You've heard about that, haven't you? Seminole Wars? Do you know that there's no such thing as a Seminole? Seminole doesn't exist. Seminole was a Creek word for runways. And those slaves who escaped from the Carolinas and from Virginia down through what eventually became Georgia. Georgia became a state to block the movement of escaped slaves into Florida. Did you know that? That's how they set it up, as, in quotes, a free state. And there in Florida, the blacks were called Seminoles first. Black escapees who went into Florida, who were welcomed by the Native Americans there. And there you had some of the most interesting Native Americans in the entire hemisphere. There was a group called the Calusas, and the Tequestas, and the Apalaches, and even their enemies write about them with respect, because they were some really bad Native Americans. I mean, they... when Ponce de Leon came, and you know we have at the Exploratorium a film on Cabeza de Vaca, this who went with the Narvaez expedition, and I'm going to... interesting to see how they're going to do this film. How I learned about the resistance there in Florida is that you have to read a book by a half Native American who was related to the Inca kings. His name was Poma de Ayala. And he had oral testimony from soldiers who had actually fought in Florida. And when Ponce de Leon arrived there, he arrived like a conquistador. And I must tell you quickly how he arrived. It was the Taino pilots who showed him how to navigate those treacherous waters of the Bahamas. Bahama comes from Spanish Bahamar, the shallow sea. Then you anglicize it as Bahamas. So in there you can wreck your ships every second. And the Taino pilots, who were brilliant at navigation and at astronomy and at looking, the science of looking at the motion of waves and judging the distances from land, which, you know, only recently the Smithsonian had some white scholar discover that those black folks in the Pacific were navigating the entire Pacific Ocean in their catamaran boats. And they could look at the motion of the waves and the wind and tell the distances from land in that big, vast Pacific. So this is what the Tainos taught to Ponce de Leon. And he got past that Bahama current and he got to Florida. He immediately fell on the Native Americans and began slaughtering them after they welcomed him. These murderous Spanish and genocidal Spaniards. And what the Calusas did, they waited for him to come back. And then they feted, wined, and dined them for 4 days. And then they fell upon them and killed every single one. They left 6 alive, but barely alive. They wounded them so that the wound would work in enough time when they got back to Cuba to spread the word. Don't come back here. There's some serious folk here. And of course, they never learned, so they came back again. Ponce de Leon, we told, you know, he went to look for the Fountain of Youth. They ended his search. 6 days after he arrived in Cuba, he died from the wounds that the Calusas had put upon him. What that did for the Calusas, they learned instantly the logistics of making special arrows that could neutralize the power of horses. They made special bows and arrows with special trajectories and force, and they would put their archers in the trees, and they could shoot an arrow right through the body of a horse. So when you read about how the Indians, you know, the Indians, in quote, were terrified of horses, the Calusas dealt with the horses. And then with armor, after killing the Ponce de Leon fellows in armor, they took the armor, they stuffed it with straw, they hung it up on a tree, and they found every weak spot through which their spears and arrows could go. So when the Spaniards came back, they were ready for them. They could take care of the armor, they could take care of the horses, and they were more brilliant tacticians in their own land. They could lure. So Alion goes next. And again, he went to a different part of the northern Florida coast. And when he was there, these Apalaches welcomed him, gave them food and drink. And then Alion invited about 300 of the Native Americans on the ships. And when they came aboard, they simply battened down the hatches and started taking them away as slaves. And every single one of them committed suicide before they got to Cuba, rather than face enslavement and this terrible act of treachery. And then Alion made the mistake of going back again. And this time they were ready for him. Once again they feted wine and dine. And they said to him, Allion, why are you fighting for this distant monarch across the sea? We are warriors, and we would have more respect for you if you came looking out for yourself and your people here. We could share some things with you and show you some techniques of surviving here. Anyway, when the Calusas were finished with Allion, he and about three others managed to get back to Puerto Rico. For 100 years, the Native Americans in Florida kept the European settlers at bay. You hear about Herman de Soto, how de Soto discovered the Mississippi. De Soto was utterly and totally defeated by those Native Americans. I'm telling you this because the tradition of resistance filtered into the blacks who were coming in now into Florida, and who were going to write one of the great epic chapters of a struggle in the Colombian era. And you are told in the history books about two Seminole wars. The first, the blacks were called Seminoles. Then when the Creek Nation broke up and Sacafaca took his group over the border into Florida, these Creeks were called Seminoles. So there's no cohesive or logical Seminole. It was a word used to describe the people who had come into Florida from the north. And that alliance of the Native Americans and the Africans in Florida held in spite of every effort to break it. You heard about Osceola. Many black people call their children Osceola. Osceola married a black woman, and when he went to have talks with Thompson, General Thompson, at the Fort Gaines, slave catchers captured his wife, and his wife in the Seminole language was called Cochicher, which means morning dew. And this sister was a fighter, because the slave catcher who took her, the news came out after that she killed him and committed suicide. But Osceola swore that he would avenge this black woman's capture. And Thompson, the general, he and his men followed him for 2 years. And one night after Thompson had a good dinner and was coming out of his veranda, they filled him with about 14 shots from their rifles. And Osceola, after he fell, shouted, you know, "I remember the hour," he said. So we have to remember ours too, you see. No black woman was ever defended in a war in this hemisphere until Osceola fought. He fought, the first Seminole War was fought over that capture of Cochicher. And amongst these groups, you know how we get the research about the Seminole Wars? You have to go to New England, into the libraries, and into the parish records. And there are letters from white soldiers who were fighting in Florida, who wrote home about what was happening. Because it was a felony for any journalist to mention that blacks were fighting in Florida. That's why you don't know about it. And that fight went on, and amongst the great leaders who emerged was Abraham. He is one of the great black leaders in this North American history. All of the whites who write about Abraham, even though they hate him, write about him with respect. Abraham was a brilliant man, a brilliant fighter, a brilliant tactician. He knew several languages, and he was one of the chief negotiators. See, while the Spanish owned Florida, Abraham knew that they could stay free. But when the United States bought Florida in 1819, they knew now that the whole might of the United States was going to be turned against them. And that's exactly what happened. By the late 1840s, two-thirds of all the United States armed forces were fighting against black and Seminole insurgents in Florida. Two-thirds. Over 50,000 troops. It's the greatest war in which the U.S. fought until Vietnam. And Abraham at one point called his followers together and said, "We are fighting for the liberation of all oppressed peoples in this hemisphere. We will never sign a treaty with our enemies." And the whole nation had to vote, and one faction voted that they would sign a treaty. And Abraham and Atlasa, or Tiger Cat, he was called in the Coacoochee, in the Seminole language, it means Tiger Cat. He was Abraham's counterpart among the Native Americans. And they left Florida when the whole, after defeating over and over again some of the mightiest of the armies the U.S. had mounted, including now Schlesinger, that historian, writes a biography of Jackson, Andrew Jackson, Stonewall Jackson. Do you know that the blacks in Florida wasted Jackson? He fought at Suwannee. There, that small town, Suwannee is a Seminole word, which means the river of reeds. And there, Atlasa and Abraham met Jackson's forces, and Abraham begged for the right to be the first to attack them. So he held the right wing, and they tore to pieces Jackson's forces. And he was frothing with rage. Here were blacks who he believed were inferior. And the tactics, some of the tactics they used, they played on Jackson's racism. They sent some blacks in front to look as though they were minstrels. They were chewing and playing banjo and jiving around. And so Jackson let his guard down, you know. So he's coming on now to wipe these blacks off the face of the earth. And right there in those hammocks,